There is a hunger strike going on in New York State ahead of the end of the legislative session there. Activists are trying to convince lawmakers to end long-term solitary confinement and restrict any solitary confinement to people between 21 and 55. It comes as the Trump campaign's 70-year-old former campaign chairman Paul Manafort is reportedly headed for isolation in the Rikers Island Jail in New York. New York is just one of many states considering changing policies around solitary, which is commonly used in the U.S. and is described as torture when used for more than 15 days by the International Standards for Prisoner Treatment. Those are called the Nelson Mandela Rules. Joining us now is Judith Resnick, who's a professor of law and the founding director of the Arthur Lyman Center for Public Interest Law at Yale Law School. Judith, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to join you.
And 15 days, that's not a lot in the United States when it comes to people who are in solitary confinement, right?
Sad to say that working with an association of state correctional administrators, which are the chief executive officers around the country running prison systems, the Lyman Center has for the last several years gathered data on the aggregate number on how many people are in 22 hours or more, 15 days or more, 30 days or more. And our most recent numbers counts almost 2,000 people who've been in for 6 years or more. Hmm. We first started asking in 2014, and we estimated that 80 to 100,000 people in the United States were in solitary confinement. The better news is the numbers have gone down in terms of aggregate information. But as you know from the uproar about Paul Manafort or any individual that is spending all one's time in a tiny cell, mm-hmm. often with no natural light, with food through a slot in the door, potentially indefinitely, can be terrifying for anyone and disabling for most people.
So why are the people who are in solitary confinement in the U.S. there? Are they in there for many different reasons?
There are three big buckets. The first, which is that officials say that they need to protect individuals. So there's something called protective custody. The second is disciplinary segregation. You were alleged to and found to have done something wrong. And the third is a generic called administrative segregation that often translates into we're scared of you or worried about you in some way. And the rules sometimes describe a person as being perceived to be a quote-unquote threat to the security of the institution. Now, just to be clear, everybody needs to be safe in prison from each other, from other people, from the staff, and the staff needs to be safe. But to distinguish the need to separate someone from the degradation, that incredible, profound isolation works. We're social animals, and I use the word animal here because there's a good many studies on animals. And so the idea that people need human contact with each other, we take for granted because most of us live in contact, and now we're taking away a human's way of living.
Who gets to make the decision about putting someone into solitary confinement and how long they're going to be there?
Well, that's a great question because that's part of the current debate. Historically, the people who run prisons have made this decision and made it basically unfettered. There have been debates for centuries about whether what they'd call dungeons or dark cells. Now we might call them lit cells because sometimes the lights are on 24/7. Over the last decades, in part as prisoners became people with rights, the prisoners have gone to court and said, you can't treat me as a human being like this. So courts have become involved, and legislatures are increasingly involved in asking and sometimes in regulating how long or if people can be kept in isolation. Huge credit goes to prisoners, and I just think it's important to remember that in the 1960s and before, courts talked about prisoners as civilly dead, as people without rights at all. Mm. And these prisoners, like Nelson Mandela, they imagined a world that took them as human beings rather than a world that totally subjugated them. And they pressed for and convinced federal judges who had for years said, hands off, defer to corrections people, to say, yes, you too are a human being with dignity, rights, and the Constitution doesn't stop at the prison's gates.
What kind of research has been done into the long-term effects on the people who are held in solitary confinement for, you know, in the case of somebody like Albert Woodfox, 40 years in Louisiana he was in solitary.
43. Yes, Angola. Sociologists, psychologists, and neurologists are all looking at the effects of long-term confinement, and actually some look at short-term confinement. The former head of the Corrections Department of Colorado wrote an op-ed in the New York Times. He was locked in for under a day, and he said, this is intolerable. But basically, the short answer is, it's disabling. People need social interaction, and they also need physical activity. I heard Albert Woodfox talk a couple years ago about how he realized that he was losing his depth perception because he never could look further than a few feet and tried to do exercises to keep his own eyesight in shape. Think about your body not moving beyond a tiny square. If you are lucky enough and the rules are obeyed, you may be out of cell in another stone enclosure, sometimes with no skylight, for an hour a day, maybe in some systems, and who knows what the weather is when you haven't a chance to go outside.
Well, and also, if you are somebody who has mental illness already, to be put into that situation, it's probably even worse.
I think we're all vulnerable if we're put in solitary, but there certainly are subpopulations for whom this would be particularly oppressive. And please don't leave out of the calculation the physically disabled. You can't walk, or you can't see, or you can't hear, and you're in a cell. The missing piece in the discussion is to think it's sort of called solitary. You're actually in an incredibly intense interpersonal relationship with the people on the other side of the door. And you are 100% dependent on them for everything. Mm-hmm. And that should take all of our breaths away.
You know, Jason Rezaian, who is the Washington Post columnist who was imprisoned in Iran for 544 days, was in solitary confinement there. And he, when there was news about Paul Manafort going into solitary, Jason Rezaian tweeted out, solitary confinement is torture. It should be outlawed everywhere. This is somebody obviously with experience.
The big point is, over the course of human history, people have punished the duly convicted in a bunch of different ways, some of which today we think of as disgusting. Branding and whipping. And Arkansas whipped prisoners in 1965, and three federal judges said, as long as you give them some procedural fairness, it's okay. It wasn't until 1968 when then Justice Blackmun, he was on the Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit, said, this violates the Eighth Amendment. You can't do this to people. For many decades, the people who ran corrections facilities said, this is a good system. This is an important way in which we maintain security. Increasingly, the leadership of many correctional systems now understands that solitary isn't the answer to a problem, but is a problem to be solved. Unraveling it when you've already have at least 60,000 or more people who've been subjected to it is the challenge of the next weeks, months, years, and we look to the jurisdictions that are saying, we've got to give hard stops. We've got to keep nobody in for 22 or 3 hours a day without outside activity. So you see some statutes saying at least 4 hours out, some systems saying, let's look at 8 hours out. You can keep people safe and secure. It's labor intensive, but it is worse and more labor intensive and inhumane to use the profound isolation as a form of punishment or control. There's also growing information that it doesn't actually make anybody safer. We found in our report from a couple years ago that at least 3,000 people went from profound isolation to the streets. No one thinks that's a good idea. And we also see that it is not clear that it keeps prisons safer. It's also a terrible job for the people who do the policing. It's horrific for the people subjected to it. It's bad for the institutions that subject people to it.
So given all that you've said about it, why is it that the use of solitary confinement has been increasing in recent decades?
So I'm hoping we're looking at, you can figure out the curve, whether you want to call bell or whatever. I'm hoping we're looking at the downward side of it. The basic story is as prisoners' populations grew, we're talking 1980s, war on crime, war on drugs, we started seeing the rise and funding for things called supermaxes, which are prisons designed to isolate. And by the late 1990s, there was counts of at least 25,000 people in supermax facilities. We started counting in 2014. And at that point, we looked at about 1.5 million people in prison. And of the 1.5 million, we found 80 to 100,000, a huge number in these profound isolating circumstances. Since those numbers have come out, and this is a joint project with the people who run prisons who are concerned about this, we're looking at efforts to have those numbers come down. And a report the Lyman Center and the Association of State Correctional Administrators put out last October, talks about four jurisdictions working to make change: Colorado, Idaho, Ohio, and North Dakota, with leaders saying, how can we cut the population, limit it, or stop it altogether? So you're looking at a movement for abolition of solitary confinement, and you're also looking at efforts to reduce it. Key, by the way, to this has to be responsible funding, because resources are needed to change the facilities and to staff the facilities. We need to increase the training, and we need to shift the work from grotesque disabling activities to enabling people to be part of our social order and return as responsible citizens in it.
That is Judith Resnick, who is a professor of law and founding director of the Arthur Lyman Center for Public Interest Law at Yale University. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm glad that you're looking at hard problems in the United States. Thank you.